The details behind the Diddy indictment, Taylor Swift's stalkers, Jerry Lee trying to kill Elvis. Disgraceland dives into the dark side of entertainment every Tuesday. Follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Our anchorman, Paul Rasmussen, learning a lot more this morning as details are coming in from our nation's capital after the mid-air collision of the American Airlines regional jet and the Black Hawk Army helicopter over the Potomac River just short of a runway at that airport. 67 souls have perished. That said, Paul, your takeaway from what we now know that we didn't yesterday.
Well, a couple of things. First, we have a new detail on the air traffic control situation. It turns out there were two controllers at work. One of those two controllers was handling both helicopter and airline traffic. Now, I don't know exactly if it's supposed to be this way. What they are saying is that it appears they're saying that one person would handle one and one person would handle the other, which would tell you that there's a lot of helicopter traffic if they split work up that way, right?
Certainly is in that area.
And then the other thing would be the NTSB now has the black boxes. So that's the very start. They want to release an interim report in about 30 days, which is pretty fast for the NTSB to turn around information on something this tragic and this complex. Plus, there's all the wreckage that has to be gotten out of the Potomac. It's going to take time for that to happen. It's going to be several months before we know. A very, very long time. And there'll be a lot of speculation. We had a caller earlier, a veteran, who offered the information that the night vision goggles that the helicopter pilot and co-pilot may have been wearing, probably were. Well, actually, the defense secretary said they were. So that they can distort depth perception. Which is interesting because the chopper was supposed to be flying at 200 feet and the collision may have happened at 400 feet. Now, how would the depth perception be different? I don't know.
And this was just short of, again, the runway. And that's another part of the story we're hearing, that the traffic controllers asked the pilot of the passenger jet to change runways that they were expected to land on.
Yeah, they're not parallel. They're at different angles from one another, but not terribly so. But again, that last-minute adjustment may have played some kind of a role. We also know that from listening to the air traffic control exchanges with the helicopter pilot, that they asked the pilot if they had the regional jet in sight, right?
Right.
And then he was ordered to go around behind the regional jet. So perhaps they didn't know what the spacing was. Maybe there was a mistake in judging the spacing between the aircraft. I mean, there's so many possibilities here, Larry.
And I think what people want to know is, hey, am I safe to fly? Well, consider, as we mentioned, and it's worth repeating, this is the first passenger jet crash in this country in 15 years.
And I would like to add that I can't say when the last mid-air collision was. The last one I remember was in the 70s when a private plane and a Pacific Southwest 727 collided over San Diego and the PSA jet went down in a neighborhood.
And there were a
lot of deaths. But, I mean, it's been, I don't know how many decades since we've had a mid-air collision. That's almost unheard of.
And our Air Force caller who utilized night vision goggles said that he reminded us that the late Senator John Hines was part of a helicopter aircraft. Now, it wasn't a passenger jet, but they collided and took his life. And that was, 35 years ago. So these incidents are extremely rare. And statistically, you are much safer flying than driving at any point. That said, they'll continue to get the details. If this hadn't happened, what do you suspect people would be talking about, Paul? One of the things is the very contentious hearings with Robert Kennedy Jr.
And
the others going through the process to get confirmation for their cabinet appointments. And that said, CBS's Meg Oliver will start there with Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
The Senate Health Committee's top Republican said he's struggling with Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination.
So, that's my dilemma, man.
Senator Bill Cassidy is a physician and says he's concerned by Kennedy's misleading arguments about vaccines.
If you come out unequivocally, vaccines are safe, it does not cause autism, that would have an incredible impact.
But earlier, Kennedy said he'd first have to see the data.
If you show me data, I will be the first person to assure the American people to take that they need to take those vaccines.
Tulsi Gabbard asked senators to confirm her as director of national intelligence and defended her position on Russia.
I want to make certain that in no way does Russia get a pass in either your mind or your heart, or in any policy recommendation you would make or not make.
Senator, I'm offended by the question because my sole focus, commitment, and responsibility is about our own nation.
Trump loyalist Kash Patel faced questions on his nomination to lead the FBI.
And I've never once advocated for political violence or violence against law enforcement.
Democrats called his statements about January 6 defendants disqualifying.
I'm talking about his characterization of criminals who assaulted police officers as political prisoners.
While his nominees make their case to Congress, President Trump returned to a campaign theme, instructing schools to promote a patriotic education. An executive order threatens to withhold funding from schools that teach about gender ideology or critical race theory. Meg Oliver, CBS News, New York.
And those hearings will continue in our nation's capital today. So to sort through, I don't know how long this process is going to take, Paul, but it looks like it's going to be a little while anyway. Meanwhile,
the hearing process has gotten so toxic. Just to speak on a personal level, I don't watch them anymore.
It's a lot of grandstanding on one hand, and then on the other hand, well, grandstanding either positively or negatively. And so these senators...
And they exchange roles. It doesn't matter which party is in control and which party is in control right. at the White House. Everybody... It's just like after an election. Either party, either side will say, well, we were robbed.
They got their 2 cents in. They know they're in the limelight, especially
right.
with Robert Kennedy. Because,
yes.
you know, there are people that maybe are interested because they know this is going to be a contentious situation. So
I know
it's like a prize fight.
In his opening statement, RFK was Jr. was saying that he's not anti-vaccine. And immediately someone in the gallery jumped up and started yelling and shouting in opposition.
They had to take them out.
Yeah, it's just
physically.
So I look at the reports, you know, reporters that I trust who cover these things to kind of get a sense of what's going on because there's just so much political theater involved.
Every single day this year, there has been some level of this drama.
Yeah.
And it's likely to continue. It's 8:15 at KDKA from the PJ Fitzpatrick Home Improvement Traffic Center. Triple A traffic powered by Bowser Genesis of Monroeville. Let's check on traffic conditions, Ellen.
All right. Thanks, gentlemen. And so far, so good out there. We do have some of the usual delays in your way, but I'm not reporting any accidents or other kinds of obstacles. If you're making the Friday morning commute, for example, on Route 28, you do have some brake lights collecting between the 40th and 31st Street bridges. At times, a little sluggish from that point down toward the exit for East Ohio Street or maybe the ramps to the North Shore Expressway. Parkway North, I-279 rolls along well. HOV lane is open for you. You are getting some heavier traffic as you come across the 579 corridor after you get off of the Veterans Bridge and head either to the exits for 6th and 7th Avenues or across to the Liberty Bridge or the Boulevard of the Allies. Parkway West inbound is sluggish from the top of Greentree Hill down through those Fort Pitt tunnels, and you're lining up on the Parkway East inbound between Wilkinsburg and Edgewood-Swissvale. Our next AAA traffic on the 5s at 825. I'm Ellen Gamble on 100.1 FM and AM 1020 KDKA.
Thanks, Ellen. AccuWeather says overcast. We're getting some real light rain here and there, drizzle. 53 will be the high. Overcast, yes, but above freezing, and that because of the snowpack in some areas creating patches of fog all morning, and then we'll drop to 25. There could be a couple of slick spots overnight, then sunny and 34 tomorrow, 46 on Groundhog Day on Sunday. And right now we're at 40 degrees at the airport. The freeze and thaw can cause a lot of issues for a lot of reasons. I mean, look at the roads. Yeah, that's one example. And take a real close look. Things on your house, like your roof. JP Roofing and Siding is here. Joe Potocznik entering 44 years of doing what he does best, taking care of you. Service excellence, product excellence, MVP with Owens Corning, upper 1% of everybody in America that does what he does. Nobody does it better. And how that translates to you, workmanship, the warranty, lifetime warranty, and giving you the best deal possible with the confidence that it's going to get done right. And you can get a free estimate. Highly recommend you just call, get a free estimate. There's no reason you shouldn't. You can compare that to anything else. You'll know what I mean. 412-829-7711. JP Roofing. President Trump putting in a memo in an executive order about the funding. We talked about that at the beginning of the week. A pause on grants and loans. Then a federal judge paused the pause. And then Donald Trump rescinded that for now, but said they'd take a look at it. But it caused a backlash and kind of a wrinkle. And it's gone through on many levels in some cases that you wouldn't consider. And joining us from the University of Pittsburgh is Professor Greg Kaplan. Good morning, Craig.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
What people might be surprised to know is the National Institutes of Health grants. Pittsburgh is third in the country regionally because there's that much research going on in this region, correct?
Oh, yeah. Pittsburgh is a national leader. This is a major economic engine for our city, for Western Pennsylvania, and the larger region.
So in your circles, you know, University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon, Duquesne University, and other institutes, when you heard about the pause, I'm sure that caused great pause for you and your colleagues.
Yeah, let me tell you, this has been an incredibly stressful week, but, you know, it's ongoing. Programs are still being canceled. People funded by the National Science Foundation that have fellowships that have to draw their salaries directly from NSF, they're actually not getting paid.
Well, wait a minute. They're not. I thought there was a pause on the pause here.
No, the NSF has, they've been directed that they are ignoring that judge's order. They're still scrubbing programs. They're still canceling programs. They've canceled review panels, which means it's a huge backlog in applications because they're not going to get reviewed in a particular cycle. So the pause is pretty much still going on.
Craig, how much money are we talking about here in terms of grant money at the University of Pittsburgh for this kind of research? Can you give us a guesstimate?
The University of Pittsburgh gets millions and millions and millions, but because we don't quite know which programs are going to be affected. So even if some programs are going to continue, if those programs have been disrupted, for example, if they've canceled review or if they've canceled funding decisions, then all this investment in this research that's been invested for years and years, because it's always about the lead time, right? It's about the lead time to establish these projects.
They might
be kicked down the road. Yeah, go ahead.
Which would go back way before the previous administration in many cases.
Oh, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So this crosses party lines.
Oh, for sure. So there's a project called the Science Education Partnership Award. It's a very small program at NIH, but it's been running since 1991. And it's to get research into K-12 situations. So my colleague, Bob Cooper, in the micro department here, who, by the way, is the president-elect of the American Society of Microbiology, that's the caliber of scientists we have in Pittsburgh. He's been running a program that helps 1,500 high school students in Pittsburgh and surrounding counties every year. That program's been terminated.
Terminated?
I don't know if, right? The program announcement, it's been running every year since 1991. And generally, they make an announcement that says we're going to have it for three more years, for three more years, for three more years, that type of thing, right? So it's been renewed for however many years that is, multiple administrations. And they don't know if they're going to even have the last year of their funding.
So,
and
to give
certainly
you,
it's been canceled going forward. Go ahead.
Well, I want to answer Paul's question because I found the exact number. The University of Pittsburgh receives, these are NIH grant recipients, top 10, 2024, $661 million. And it's second behind University of Pennsylvania. Children's Hospital in Philadelphia is third, Penn State fourth, and so on. But we're talking about a lot of money.
I'd like to know, Craig, if the canceled programs are the ones that have been, you know, suspended, is there a chance that they'll be renewed after review?
Well, they should be because they're, many of them are congressionally mandated. But it does seem like many of these programs are not coming back. They're already listed as being terminated, or, for example, there's a program announcement that says what it runs through. They've all been adjusted, and their termination dates are today.
Today?
Yeah.
Is there any recourse? Certainly, you've talked about how to plea for a continuation of the funding. In some cases, these are obviously research projects that can directly and have saved lives.
Yes, and many of the programs are the programs designed about outreach and accessibility and enhancing diversity in our scientific workforce. But this is the next generation of scientists, right? These are showing people what science does, reaching out into different communities, for example, rural communities that don't have the same opportunities. So these programs are huge, and this is a major part of the National Science Foundation, and it's congressionally mandated. And even the programs that do come back, if you've missed a grant cycle because you now have to wait 6 months to put the project back in, you potentially are laying people off.
What are you going to do?
Well, I'm on here talking to you, so to help you talk about it, I talk to my elected officials to try to let them know what we're doing and why it's so important, and that you just can't be a bull in a china shop here in terms of the NSF is essentially unplugged currently, and you can't unplug a major organization, even if it's just for a few weeks, right? The ripples are going to last for years.
So the fact that we heard it was rescinded in this case isn't true.
It's definitely not true.
All right.
Scientists paid by the NIH can't order supplies for their labs.
Well, to be continued. Appreciate you sharing. I know it's obviously very personal, and we'll try to find out what's going on and if there's a way to reverse it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Larry. I really appreciate you having me on.
All right, University of Pittsburgh Professor Craig Kaplan. So this is a part of the story we haven't heard. This is new information, Paul.
I didn't know. I thought that the temporary injunction that was issued until they had a hearing on all this on Monday would have stopped any activities. But the professor's alleging that it's ongoing.
It's now. Today's the last day. And he said that they were told to ignore the judge's order anyway. And we'll see. Marty Griffin, 10 until 2, followed by Colin Dunlap, 2 to 6. Taking you through the afternoon. Larry Richard on the Big K Morning Show will continue to bring whatever news is out of our nation's capital regarding the mid-air collision that occurred on Wednesday night with the American Airlines passenger jet, 60 passengers, 4 crew members, and a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter with 3 soldiers on board. Also, there has been a lot of focus on the nomination process, as there always has, but maybe none more contentious than Robert Kennedy Jr. when it comes to one subject that we've heard a lot about is vaccines. And joining us is Candace Mateus, who is the Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for an organization called Partnership to Fight Infectious Disease. Candace, welcome to KDK.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So give us a little background on your organization. and what you're trying to do, because it's not just all about vaccines, correct?
That's right. The Partnership to Fight Infectious Disease, we're a group of concerned patient groups, providers, community organizations, academic researchers, and infectious disease experts, and really working to raise awareness about the threats posed by infectious disease generally and advancing solutions to address those. And that includes antimicrobial resistance or antibiotic resistance that many people may have heard about, and also empowering informed choice and confidence in vaccines that have conquered diseases over time. And we continue to see a lot of innovation in that area.
So we know some of these work for sure. And then you have a smaller percentage of Americans who are very dubious about vaccines. But in this case, the man who has been nominated to take over our health department, the lines are kind of blurred. We've heard him say he's not against them on one hand, and then we've heard him say in the past that he is. Kind of sort through the details of what you know about Robert Kennedy Jr.
Sure. Well, one thing I wanted to say about the poll, which is really encouraging, but then, you know, the fragility of it is highlighted by what you're talking about with the statements that RFK Jr. has made in the past and continue to make in the hearings this week. First is that the norm for Americans is to get vaccinated. They follow the advice. They look to their trusted healthcare provider, doctor, nurse, pharmacist, and follow that advice for themselves and for their children. And they're focused in on, you know, protecting themselves. That is the key reason that they seek vaccination. The challenge that that we are concerned about is that, as you mentioned, RFK Jr. talks about he's not anti-vaccine, but he's pro-safety. Everyone is pro-safety. Everyone in the public health community, the FDA, the CDC, everyone is pro-safety. Those comments, though, kind of may imply that maybe people aren't, or maybe he's more pro-safety. And that can kind of help to seed doubt in people. But the poll, again, was very encouraging in that people are getting those questions answered by their healthcare provider, and they're seeking that information from healthcare, you know, their own personal healthcare expert, and not necessarily politicians, if you will.
So what do we do at this point? I mean, if Robert Kennedy becomes the health secretary, what do you think happens?
Well, there's some real concerns. And you saw the encouraging part about the hearings this week is that on a bipartisan basis, senators were questioning his beliefs in vaccines and really highlighting the success of vaccines as a public health intervention for decades, and the research and the safety profile. And that was really encouraging to hear. The challenge, of course, is the fragility. When we, in our poll, we saw vast majorities of people, again, that get vaccinated. That is the norm. We see people who, you know, get their children vaccinated. But even at high majorities, the level of vaccination rate that we need to avoid outbreaks is over 90% for many of these diseases. So that shows the fragility. And when you have people in positions of power and authority that cast doubt, there are a lot of concerns that we're going to see those numbers drop, and that will leave us vulnerable to outbreaks.
Those numbers 100% are going to drop if that's the case. I'm forecasting that because there's people that just did it because we were just asked to do it. Like, what's mandated to go to a public school? What vaccines must you have for your children?
Well, it's interesting because that can vary state to state, and it's a partnership between the state and the federal government. The federal government, through CDC and an independent advisory group called the ACIP, or Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, will make recommendations. And then each state looks at those recommendations and may adopt them wholesale, may make changes, and they decide what mandates to put in place. Now, our poll found that the vast majority of Americans are very worried about declining vaccination rates among children, and they support mandates. But we're seeing those issues pop up more and more, where there are more exceptions perhaps granted. And then again, that lowers that level of vaccination that we need for community immunity that protects children who can't be vaccinated, protects children who you know, maybe have a younger sibling. Maybe they go to school, they're vaccinated, but their younger sibling isn't old enough to get vaccinated. So there are a lot of risks, and we really need those high level of vaccination rates to protect those vulnerable people.
Well, the vaccination subject seems to be the real firestorm issue with Robert Kennedy Jr. We'll see where it goes. Appreciate your time this morning, Candace. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity.
Candace DeMatteis, who is the Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for the Partnership to Fight Wherever You Go, AUDACY, and also log on to kdkradio.com where you can see many of our guests with our live stream, and you can also watch Inside the Studios presented by Metropolitan Window Company. After this mid-air collision tragedy on Wednesday night, once you start to hear the background of the people who lost their lives, that's when it takes another turn of emotion and grief and shock. And with the skating family part of it, CBS's Beth Germano, just outside of Boston.
The rink was empty at the Skating Club of Boston after six members from this elite figure skating community were killed aboard the American Airlines flight that crashed near Washington, D.C. Doug Zegheib is the CEO.
Our rink is eerily quiet. Coaches are not coming in. Kids are not coming in. I think everybody's mourning privately.
The club is mourning the loss of 13-year-old Gina Han and 16-year-old Spencer Lane, two up-and-coming skaters. Han's mother Jin and Lane's mother Christine were also on the plane, along with their children's coaches, Vadim Nomov and Jenya Shishkova. Douglas Lane lost his wife and his son.
Was just loved by everyone, from the adults running the club to the smallest skaters to the people that are, you know, competing for a shot at the Olympics. They all just adored him.
Their Russian-born coaches, Shishkova and Nomov, were married. They won the pairs title at the World Championship in 1994 and competed in the Winter Olympics twice. Their son, Maxime, a competitive figure skater for the U.S., was not on the plane.
They grew up in St. Petersburg. They learned a very traditional Russian style of skating and training. That is something they brought here.
Former Olympic ice skater Nancy Kerrigan, an alumna of the Skating Club of Boston, came to the training facility to lend her support.
The main lesson I think learned in skating is you get back up. Keep on trying, and even when it's hard, you get back up.
This is not the first time tragedy has struck this club. In 1961, the entire 18-member U.S. figure skating team was killed after their plane crashed as it was landing in Brussels. Almost half the plane's passengers were members of the Skating Club of Boston, according to the CEO.
I'm right here.
Paul George was part of the club, but was still competing at the junior level, so he was not on the plane.
In 1961, I said, that's the day the music stopped, and the same has happened here again.
The coach's son, Maxime, was supposed to compete next weekend, but it's unclear if he will skate or if any other events or competitions will be postponed. In the meantime, the club says it will be up to individual skaters to decide when they are comfortable to return to the ice. For CBS News, I'm Beth Germano in Norwood, Massachusetts.
And Larry, about mid-air collisions, just how rare are they? Well, the most recent mid-air collision involving a regional jet was in 1990. At Gadsden, Alabama. There was another one before that in 1987, but those were regional jets. The last time we had a massive loss of life was in 1978. The Pacific Southwest 727 and the private plane went down in San Diego. 144 people were killed. That's how infrequent this is.